like to thank Hearst Ranch for sponsoring the show tonight. Hi, and welcome to Why We Cook on the Heritage Network Radio Network. I'm your host, Erica Wides. I'm a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in Manhattan. This show is going to be kind of an exploration of what drives us to cook, not only generally speaking as a species seeking nutrition on a daily basis, but also what drives individuals who have chosen to pursue cooking as a vocation, as a passion, as a life's calling. What drives us to alter our food with heat? What makes us crave certain combinations, exotic flavors? Why are we not satisfied with eating the way other mammals eat? Why do we seek out interesting foods, and why do we choose to apply heat to them and alter them in so many ways? What essentially is it about being human that gives us the need and the ability to alter our food to our liking? We'll talk a lot about that, and along with that, we'll also talk a lot about technique. Not only why do we cook, but how do we actually cook? And how have those techniques evolved? And how do those techniques apply to different cultural groups, different ethnic groups? How does geography play into it? How does climate play into it? How does history and religion and all of those things that make us human, how do they all affect how we cook? And since I'm a chef instructor at a major metropolitan culinary school, there will, of course, be an educational side to the show. We'll go really in-depth in technique. We'll talk about specific ingredients. And then, of course, there will be a short quiz at the end of every broadcast. So take notes. Just kidding. Each week, we'll focus on a different style or a different technique of cooking, too, and look at that technique really in depth. And along with that, I can take your questions and help you to really try to understand the hows and whys of culinary technique. So if you have anything you want to ask, if you have any questions, anything you want to know, any burning culinary issues that you need to settle, you can call us in at any time at 718-497-2128. So I'm really excited about this new format, and I really look forward to hearing from you, you know, not just with culinary questions, anything else that pertains to food or the food experience as a human. After we have the educational portion of our show, we may take a few little trips around the region and visit with farmers and farmers markets and check in with other food suppliers. New York has a really great, vast array of artisanal food product makers and suppliers and farmers. We really live in a very rich agricultural region, and people tend to forget that because it's such an intensely urban experience. Some of the upcoming shows are going to feature things like artisanal salumi making in Manhattan, which is a fairly controversial subject right now because the New York City Department of Health doesn't want people to be able to make those sorts of products. And we'll talk to somebody who's kind of doing it as a rebel. We'll also look at some wild mushroom hunters in the Hudson Valley, some people who I'm friendly with. And also one that's really close to me and really interesting is we'll actually have my father on the show because he's involved in the Hudson River oyster reseeding project. And they're growing little baby oysters in the Hudson to help clean up the river. And that's pretty fascinating, too. And then in the third segment of the show, we'll be talking with chefs and cooks and all sorts of people who call the food world home. A lot of these are former students of mine who've gone through the professional program at ICE. And they've all found interesting little niches in the food world, learned how to make it work for themselves. The restaurant industry is a pretty brutal, tough place, and the burnout rate is high, and it's not an easy world to really live in. So these are some people who have really found their place after putting in their time. They've realized the importance of putting in those years on the line, but now they've really found interesting ways to make it happen. And my first guest on the show tonight, which I'm very happy about, is Jody Eddy, and she's the editor of Art Culinaire magazine. Hi, Jody.
Hi.
We'll be talking with her more later in the show, but she's also going to chime in and speak her mind and help discuss all this stuff, too. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll start talking about why we cook. I want to thank the Hearst Ranch again for sponsoring my show tonight, and I want to welcome you back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Chef Erica Wides from the Institute of Culinary Education in Manhattan. And joining me tonight is Jody Eddy, the editor of the Amazing Art Culinaire. And she's sitting with us tonight. So to begin the conversation this week, I thought we'd really talk about why do we cook? It's the name of the show. Why do humans cook their food and other mammals don't? How is it that we started doing that and the rest of the mammal world doesn't? So just to give you a little bit of background, research has shown us that cooking probably began about 1.8 million years ago when humans acquired the skill to harness and create fire. We witnessed fire on the savannas in Africa when lightning would ignite the grasses. And then when we started sharpening tools with stones, we made sparks and probably made little fires that way. But when we really learned how to harness fire, that's when we realized we could start cooking. Probably what happened, according to anthropologists, is that humans came upon just burnt up animal carcasses that had suffered an untimely fate. And they tasted them because protein was precious and found that the naturally burnt animals just tasted a lot better than the raw animals. Elton Brown, who's one of my favorite people in the food world of the show Good Eats, he just puts it very simply. He said food plus heat equals cooking. And that's really all cooking is. It's just applying heat to food in many different ways. So when humans figured it out that we could put food and fire together, they realized that not only did it taste better, but it also made it much easier for us to chew and to digest. So when we began to cook our food, it gave us access to so much more nutrition than we were ever able to take in before. We could exert a lot less of our daily energy in finding the food and sitting there chewing it, and we could put the energy into cooking it, and we were able to ingest so much more of it. And it was a pretty animal-heavy diet back then on the savannah, a lot of huntering. We were hunter-gatherers, and you could really say that that was like the original grass-fed meat diet. But as you know, if you've eaten grass-fed meat, the flavor is great, but the texture is very different than grain-fed meat. And, you know, almost 2 million years ago, that meat was probably pretty tough. So if you think about what it was like to chew up that raw meat, that was a lot of work and you had to exert a lot of effort. So our ancestors had much bigger teeth and they spent a lot more time chewing that up. They also ate a lot more raw vegetable matter and we had much larger guts because we had to actually hold in all that fiber. So the ability to cook made the food more processed and it made it easier to eat and easier to chew. And that allowed us to ingest more protein and richer food with less effort. And that's what actually gave us our big brains. So once our brains started to enlarge like that, we became much more intelligent creatures. And that's really where we made that leap away from other mammals. Now, of course, if you're an evolutionist, you believe this. If you're a creationist, then you're listening to the wrong radio station. I'm not going to get into that with you. But because of these large brains, and we also developed an upright stature, we didn't need to be bent over on the ground looking anymore. It put us at the top of the food chain, and we remain there today. We are the only animals that cook. We're at the top of the food chain. We have no more natural predators. Now, whether or not that's ultimately a good thing for our species or not, you know, will be determined, and we'll soon find that out. But you know, the future will only show that. So anyway, that's when we transitioned from that raw forage diet to a cooked diet, and we haven't really looked back ever since. Now, of course, I'm speaking from somebody in the food industry who has spent the last 17 years cooking. There is a whole faction of people out there who are all about raw diets and about the raw food approach to cooking, and some of them may disagree with me on this one, but as far as I'm concerned, the raw way of life is actually contributing to de-evolution. I think that the people who promote the raw diet are going to wind up with their brains shrinking. So what do you think, Jody? It's true?
I don't know if I want to go there, but yes, I'd have to agree.
You know, a little controversy is good. You know, now, I mean, I love a salad. I love a good salad, and I love sushi. I think actually most fish taste better raw. And I have nothing against eating some raw food, and I think a combination of the two is what's really important. But I'm not a big proponent of extremism in any way, and I think that the raw food lifestyle is just another form of extremism. To me, it's the culinary equivalent of religious fundamentalism, and I'm not a big fan of that. So, you know, whatever. You can send me hate mail. I don't care. Also, you know, there are some foods, too, that need to be cooked to deactivate natural toxins. Beans and chickpeas, all the legumes, have natural plant-based defense toxins. And if you don't cook them, you don't deactivate them. Or things like nettles, wild nettles that grow, that will sting you if you walk past them or you touch them. But if you cook them, nettles actually have one of the highest levels of plant protein of any plant food. So, you know, don't eat those raw nettles in your salad. There's a really interesting, I think looks really interesting, book coming out in late spring, by Dr. Richard Wrangham, and he teaches at Harvard. And it's a book called Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. And he talks a lot about this, but he also discusses this great idea, this great concept that the harnessing of fire and the evolution of cooking is what brought us together as a civilized society, that we all became centrally focused on this activity. We sat around the fire. We actually sat down and ate meals together instead of individually foraging. And he said that because of that, it forced us to look one another in the eye, and it forced us to make eye contact, and it forced us to suppress violence and extreme emotion because we had to function together as a group around this central focus. And I love that idea. I love all these prehistoric humans coming down from the trees and coming in and sitting down together and, you know, feasting on a big roasted woolly mammoth or, you know, whatever it was that they were eating, but that it actually civilized them. And I love that idea of looking each other in the eye and that creating this sort of civilized
community.
Exactly. It was the sort of first sense of community. I think that's just a really kind of beautiful concept. And if you think about it, you know, those kitchens and the hearth have always been the focus of homes, and people gather around them. You know, the word hearth, you know, the Latin word for hearth, which is foca, means like the focus of the home. The word focaccia comes from that. Fugas, the breads that are cooked in the hearth, they're cooked in the hearth because that's where people used to make their bread, but it means focal point. You know, the word focal point comes from that word for hearth. So that's where I'm going with that. So Jody, you know, so tell us how you feel about the raw food diet. You said you didn't want to go there.
Well, as a former chef, I mean, obviously I'm not a big proponent of it either. No.
Yeah.
No. I don't think it can really sustain you over a long period of time. And I'll probably get hate mail as well, but bring it on.
Yeah. Although I don't think the readers of Art Culinaire are necessarily raw food. Have you guys ever featured any raw food chefs?
Yeah. And probably won't.
Probably won't after this. Yeah.
And I'm fine with that.
Yeah. Right. So that's kind of, you know, the historical background. That's, you know, what I wanted to kind of get out there. The name of the show is, you know, Why We Cook. And that's why we cook, because we figured out that we could harness fire. And if we cooked our food, we would be able to eat a lot more of it. Of course, that's now not such a great thing because we eat way too much. But it's what gave us these big brains and made us who we are, made us human.
And I think from that comes our curiosity. And that's something that never ends either when you're cooking. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're constantly curious and you constantly want to learn more, and it's a never ending process. And that's what's so intriguing about cooking.
It's true. It's constantly evolving. I mean, I was teaching an egg class, and it's still, every time I can really sort of see subtleties and see differences in what I'm doing. Yeah. Okay. So let's take a brief break. And when we come back, we're going to discuss some basic technique. We're going to start the cooking school portion of the show. And then after that, we'll chat some more with Jody. So this is Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Networks, and we'll be back in a minute. I'd like to thank the Hearst Ranch for sponsoring my show tonight. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I am Chef Erica Wides from the Institute of Culinary Education in Manhattan. And before we took a break, we were talking about how humans actually became cooks, how we separated ourselves from other animals and rose to the top of the food chain because of that. So it seems like a logical place to begin talking about our actual technique discussion is just by breaking cooking down really simply into two simple categories. You can pretty much break all your cooking techniques down into these two, and those are wet heat and dry heat. Almost everything falls into those, except, you know, salads.
And raw food.
And raw food. So when we talk about those two, what we're talking about is using direct heat versus indirect heat. So dry cooking is a direct heat method. You're actually applying the heat to the food, and you're not using any liquid. So dry heat involves techniques like sautéing, grilling, baking, roasting, and frying. Whereas wet cooking involves a liquid. You're actually using liquid as the conduit for getting the heat into the food. So technically it's indirect because the heat isn't just applied directly to the food. And wet heat cooking, it involves methods like stewing and braising and poaching and steaming. So usually the decision that you have to make whether you're going to use wet heat or dry heat cooking is based on the type of food that you want to cook. So that's really the first place to begin. You decide what it is you want to cook. Am I going to cook a protein? Okay, what type of protein am I going to cook? What part of the animal is that protein from? And then how am I going to cook that? So when we're talking about those proteins and those animal parts, the first thing you have to think about is how much exercise did that part of the animal get? So when you're deciding, well, do I want to cook a steak? Do I want to cook like a lamb shank? What do I want to do? Think about that part of the animal and think about how much exercise it got and how much weight it supported. So the parts of the animal that move the most or that hold up the most weight are going to be the toughest parts of those animals. And you can even sort of compare it to like your own body. You can say, well, if I were going to try to, you know, take a bite out of my forearm, it would be a lot tougher than if someone tried to, you know, take a bite out of my stomach, because it's kind of the same way. It's like the muscles that are tougher and harder to keep tone. The tougher parts of the animals, the parts that move the most, contain the most collagen. And collagen is what holds us all together. Collagen holds our muscles together. It what keeps your face from sagging. And they put collagen into all kinds of cosmetic products because it keeps your face from falling down. And it's why I'm now doing radio instead of television. No, that's not true.
You look fabulous.
Oh, thanks. So do you. That's why I have you on. Anyway, so the more collagen that these animal parts have, the tougher they're going to be, and the more sort of tightly knit the muscle fibers are. They're, you know, much more tightly toned parts of the animal. So they'll be tougher. And collagen really only dissolves in liquid. If you took a tough cut of meat, like a lamb shank, and you put it on a grill and you grilled it for a while, it would still be tough because your collagen doesn't dissolve. When collagen dissolves, Jody, my former student, what does it turn into?
Here I am on the spot.
It starts with a G.
Gelatin.
Yes. Woo, you get an A.
I was going to have to return to school.
I know, right? Okay, so collagen dissolves, turns into gelatin. But anyway, so the more collagen these tough parts contain, the longer and slower they have to cook in liquid, because the liquid has to dissolve that collagen. And at the same time that the liquid's dissolving the collagen, the proteins are slowly cooking and firming up. So tough cuts like lamb shanks, oxtail, duck legs, rabbit legs, lamb necks, those are generally always cooked in liquid because the liquid will tenderize them. It dissolves the collagen, it firms up the proteins, and then very conveniently the collagen dissolves into the liquid, dissolves into gelatin, and gives you what we like to call mouthfeel. It sounds a little obscene, but mouthfeel is what we're looking for in a really good stew or a braise. And that mouthfeel comes from dissolved gelatin in the liquid. Or if you make a good veal stock or a good chicken stock, it's from the collagen turning into gelatin. So that's the tough cuts. Now, more tender things, more tender proteins, like chicken breasts, duck breasts, rabbit loins, most fish, any sort of chop, any kind of steak, those respond best to quick dry heat methods. Nice hot heat, really fast, really intense. They have no collagen and not too much fat in them, so there's nothing to protect them from overcooking, and you don't need time to cook down the collagen. So a really quick saute or a quick grill is ideal for those. Although occasionally there are exceptions, things like chicken breasts or salmon that will poach once in a while, but that's down the road. That's another show. That's when we get to the poaching class. Although poaching, we could skip that.
It's just as bad as raw food.
It's just as bad as raw food, unless it's properly done. So the lean and tender cuts respond best to dry heat cooking. Hot, high, fast, dry heat. Grilling, sauteing, roasting if it's a larger cut. Now, fat content is a really important factor, too, when you're deciding how to cook a specific protein, because something that's really well marbled, like a really tender, like a ribeye steak or a piece of meat that has a lot of marbling, is actually better suited to dry heat because you want to render away some of the fat. You want to let some of that fat melt. But at the same time, even though it's well marbled, it's still a tender cut of meat. So you want some of that fat to stay in there and help to lubricate the proteins and give you juiciness, or the illusion of juiciness when you bite into it. But you might buy something like a brisket, which is a fatty cut, but it's tough. So in that case, we have to braise it because we need to break down the collagen and braise it, and a lot of the fat melts out that way. So you have to think about the fat content too. But often with our dry heat cooking methods, when we're sauteing or grilling, they're leaner, tender cuts, things like chicken breasts, fish, leaner steaks, because we want to get them on the heat and get them off the heat really quick, or wrap it up really fast so we don't overcook. And temperature is also incredibly important with all of these things, because in both wet and dry heat cooking, proteins firm up as they cook. And that's what cooking a protein is all about, congealing the proteins. They just firm up. So as proteins congeal, they get firmer and they get tighter. And as those protein strands are coagulating, any moisture that's between them, any water, any juices, is being forced out. The tighter those proteins get bound up, the more juice gets pushed out. So the more well done you cook a piece of meat, the drier it's going to seem. So with wet heat cooking, we like to cook low and slow, because we don't want those proteins to overcook even though they're cooking in liquid. And with dry heat cooking, we want to cook hot and fast because we want it to be as fast as possible. Okay. Now, when we do talk about the wet heat cooking and we're talking about things like braising and stewing, what you want to remember is that liquids boil at 212. That's the boiling point. Well done with most proteins is about 165 to 170. So anytime you cook any protein in liquid, you never ever want to let the liquid boil. Because if the liquid boils, your proteins are going above that temperature, you're squeezing out all your liquid, and even though you're cooking in liquid, you're still going to have dry meat, which explains all the pot roast that I ate growing up as a child,
as did we
which all. Cooked all day in liquid, but still was like shredded sandals, so which I never figured out until I became a professional and figured that out. So to sum it up, a good general rule is, if it's a well-exercised body part, cook it slowly with moisture. If it's a very lean, tender part, cook it fast and dry. And if you're still not sure, talk to the person you're buying it from. Talk to your butcher. Talk to the person who raised the animal. Talk to the producer. They'll let you know. They'll help you out. And, you know, and if you're still really unsure, you can look it up, or you can match the body parts to your body. But that's what I always tell my students. Like, think about which part of your body is the hardest to keep toned. It's your midsection, it's your torso, so it's basically your loin. If you had a loin, it would be your loin section. That's the most tender part of your body. The toughest parts are going to be your wrists, your ankles, your calves, your forearms, and your neck, because we use those the most. We are mammals. We break down exactly the same way. Another thing to remember is that if you happen to be in a plane crash or a survival situation and someone has to get eaten, you want to go for the least fit person on the plane, because they're going to have the most tender muscle fiber. Don't go for the athlete. Go for the typical American who may not be so fit. Okay, we're going to take another break, bring things back to a more civilized tone. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Jody Eddy of Art Culinaire Magazine. This is Why We Cook on the Heritage Radio Network. And we'll be back in a minute. Hearst Ranch again for sponsoring my show tonight. Welcome back to the final segment of Why We Cook with me, Chef Erica Wides from the Institute of Culinary Education in Manhattan. And joining me in the studio is my friend and former student and colleague, Jody Eddy, who is the editor of Art Culinaire magazine. Welcome, Jody.
Thank you so much, Chef Erica, which I can never stop calling you.
She can't drop the chef, even though now,
I shouldn't.
Now we're equals. Jody was my student at ICE. How many years ago?
About four years ago.
Mm-hmm. She was my star student.
Yes, right.
Star pupil.
Right.
She actually had
a class of one.
A great class. Right. One person in it. And after you finished the program at ICE, you did your externship.
I actually went to John George. And then another externship came through when I was at John George, and that was at Heston Blumenthal's restaurant, The Fat Duck. And right. I decided I couldn't turn it down.
Yeah.
And why not just continue to work for free?
Yeah, well, of course.
As all culinary students do.
Well, that's what this business is about.
Exactly.
Working as a slave for free until you drop dead.
Exactly.
Yeah. So can you just kind of give us a little overview of what the Fat Duck is about and what their whole
Yeah, absolutely.
Deal is?
Well, I know nobody likes to talk about it anymore. It's a buzzkill, but it's the epitome of molecular gastronomy.
Oh, right.
And essentially, I was prepping food for about 14 hours a day, and then I was in the kitchen for about 4 hours a day.
Wow.
Working 6 days a week. It was really intense.
Wow.
That's why when people ask me for London restaurant suggestions, I have no idea, because I never saw anything.
Right.
Exactly.
You never picked
up we were in a little village in the middle of nowhere, and that's what we did. We had a huge tasting menu, very impressive, but we had a laboratory upstairs, and it took us about, not me personally, but it took them about 2 years to develop a menu item.
Wow.
To get it on the menu. So obviously we weren't doing seasonal.
Wow. So it's like Ferran Adria's lab, but the English version.
Yep,
version.
Exactly.
Did Heston work with Ferran Adria? Is he a disciple?
No. He's not.
So he sort of came to it on his own.
Yep.
Wow.
Right.
And then, so you were at the Fat Duck for how long?
I was there for 4 months.
Wow.
Yep.
Grueling.
Yeah.
And then, and you also continued to write your blog. Jody has a blog called Eddie Bowls, if anybody wants to check that out. It's great.
I haven't written for a while.
That's okay. You don't have to tell anybody that. And you continued to work on that while you were there.
I did.
Because I read it while you were
away. And I started that when I was in culinary school. And it was just a way to kind of explore my interest in food history and to document my experiences as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty exhausting to go home after 17, 18 hours a day and do it. But I just felt really committed to
it. Yeah, wow.
And that was kind of something that connected my entire culinary career. You know, just always going back to edibles, no matter where I was in life. And sometimes I felt like I was writing into a vacuum. I didn't quite understand why I was doing it. But in the end, it paid off.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like keeping a journal.
Exactly.
So how did all of that lead to you at Art? Well, first of all, let's tell people what Art Culinaire is.
Yeah. We're a quarterly publication. We've been in circulation for almost 25 years. We profile about 10 chefs around the world every quarter, and they present to us recipes based upon subjects matters that we give them. And the subjects, we go in depth in terms of their history and nutritional value, etc. And we... then the chefs basically present to us 4 to 8 recipes, and that's it. It's a large, oversized, hardbound publication.
Right. It's really more like a book.
Yeah,
it is. We call it a magazine because it's a quarterly, but it is really more like a collectible book.
Yeah. I've met a lot of people who have started, you know, they have every single issue.
Right, right.
From the very first.
Yeah. I think some of my colleagues do. It's very high end. I mean, in the food world, Art Culinaire is really considered like the top.
Yeah.
It's like the most prestigious magazine. So that's pretty impressive.
We've pretty much covered any chef that you could come up with.
Yeah. And it's really like, I mean, it's considered like the highest honor to be profiled, I think, in Art Culinaire. It's pretty
amazing. Always like Christmas when you're inviting a chef to be in it.
Yeah, and you get to go to all these restaurants and I always see all your pictures on Facebook and everything. It's really incredible. What was I going to say? I totally forgot.
How did I transition in?
Yes, thank you. How did you transition in?
Right.
And I also want to make sure we get to your trip to Iceland, too. So
yeah,
how
absolutely.
Did you get in there?
After Fat Duck, I was at a New York City restaurant. And I was I was actually having a great time. I was only working 10 hours a day, which seemed like
vacation.
Heaven.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I actually suffered two herniated discs. And being a career changer, it was very, very frustrating for me. I felt like I hit a roadblock. And I just didn't know where to go with that. I continued to write edibles and basically talked about my misery for about 3 months. But I lucked out and I found my way to Art Culinaire. Yeah. And it was just a great way to combine my love of food and to still, you know, remain connected to the chefs. I still do a lot of recipe testing, and now I get to research and write.
And what's really amazing, what I don't think people realize, is there's really only two people who put the whole thing together. No?
Well, we have...
Seems to me like you do all the work.
No. No? That's just because I'm always complaining.
Oh, okay. Okay. And you just came back from Iceland.
I did,
You guys did a first ever feature on Iceland, which is amazing. We're running out of time, but I want to just talk about your trip to Iceland a little bit. Because, you know, as people may know, Iceland just had a total economic meltdown, way worse than what we're going through. But they have this really kind of hot new culinary scene that's developed over the past probably 10, 20 years. Yep. So can you just really quickly tell us about what you saw there?
What I really respected there is their love of using their local ingredients. They really have a strong slow food movement going on. Part of that is the New Nordic Manifesto, and it's essentially their slow food you know, coming from Italy. They were inspired by that, and they started this. But they're incorporating a lot of modern techniques and basically looking at trends, but almost it's just coming from the ground up. And a lot of the food reflected to me, just visually, a lot of the landscape that we saw there. It was just very inspiring. And they're really, really working on shoestrings at this point. They've gone from staffs of 20 to staffs of 2 or 1. And what I discussed with them there is possibly looking into the interns that need positions in New York at this point, because it's just such a gorgeous, amazing place to be.
Yeah, your pictures were incredible. I really want to go. It's one of those places I've always wanted to go. And it's not a place that people ever really thought of as a food destination.
Yeah. But they're so passionate about it.
They're so passionate. Absolutely. Yeah, years and years ago, I took a course at CIA, and there was an Icelandic guy there taking the class, and he was telling me about some of the things they eat, and I was really shocked. You know, like the puffin.
They do.
And we think of puffin as these sort of adorable penguin, you know, puffy birds that why would you, but you know, it's.
In one meal I actually had, this is another controversial thing, but raw whale.
Oh, I had raw whale in Japan.
Okay. Yeah. And so we had whale, puffin, horse, and putrefied shark.
Oh, I had horse in Japan.
Oh, great.
Oh, yeah, the fermented shark.
Yeah, it was quite a meal.
Yeah, had your meal afterwards.
Actually, my photographer loved it, and he ate an entire bowl of it. So they were very impressed by that.
Wow.
And then every chef seemed to know that he had done that, and he got major props.
Wow. So, but I mean, tourism must be really suffering there,
too. Yeah, it is. It is. And actually, it's an ideal time to go right now because it is a lot cheaper than it used to be.
Right. And it's midsummer, so the days are super long.
Yeah, exactly. I was standing at the foot of a waterfall at 11 p.m.
Wow.
It's just amazing.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Truly.
And so getting just back to Art Culinaire. So how long have you been there now?
For a year.
Just a year.
Yep.
That's it.
Just
wow.
a year.
And is the magazine going in the same direction? I mean, are you sort of branching out to other countries more? Is this sort of the beginning of a new trend, going to places like Iceland?
No, we've always, you know, we've traveled the world.
Yeah.
Basically anywhere that you could think of, we've been.
And how do you decide which chefs to profile?
That's a whole other program.
Show.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, well, we can get back to that next time you're here. Yeah. And just one other question about Iceland. Are they trying, I guess they're really trying to source locally because it must be so expensive to fly in.
Absolutely. But it's not just an expense. It's just really they have such a deep respect for their local ingredients.
Yeah, just like Italy. I mean, that sort of concept of Nostrano, that everything is ours and it comes from here,
exactly.
which is great.
Yeah.
We really, I mean, I think people are really, really trying to do that here in the States now, but, you know, because we're such an immigrant culture and we're so young and so new, it's not so deeply ingrained yet.
Yeah.
So coming from your Nordic heritage, as you do, did you feel any sort of resonance that way? Did you feel...
I'm actually moving there next month.
That's a strong resonance. Wow.
No, just kidding to my publisher.
Right. Your family.
Yeah, right. Oops.
Who may be listening.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Well, I think we're just about out of time, but Jody, I really want to thank you for coming on,
thank you so much.
My first guest on
great.
My
thank
show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's great to have you here, coming all the way from Morristown, too. And I want to thank all the listeners. Thanks, everybody, for joining us tonight on Why We Cook on the Heritage Radio Network. We are broadcasting live from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And it's a little bit rainy. It's not so nice, but it's still a great spot to come out to. They do some really incredible pizza and
wood-fired
pizza and great beer and heritage meats and all of that. I am Erica Wides, chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, and I'll be hosting the show every Tuesday at 6:30. But you can listen to any show from the network anytime at heritageradionetwork.com in the archives. All the shows that we broadcast are also archived, so you can listen at any time. If you have any questions, comments, you want to get in touch with us, you can email us to Lorenzo at heritageradionetwork.com. And once again, I really want to thank our sponsor, the Hearst Ranch, for giving us the opportunity to do this. Next week on our show, we're going to continue our discussion of wet and dry cooking methods, because I'm sure everybody finds it as equally fascinating as I do, maybe not, and go a little more in depth. And we're also going to start talking about salt, because salt is really the most important ingredient there is in cooking, and not just as a seasoning element, but also as a chemical element in cooking. So we're going to talk a little bit about salt next week, and we'll have a couple more guests coming up, and it should be really good. So once again, thanks a lot for joining us on Why We Cook, and we'll see you next week.